Welcome to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and pleased to have back Mark Dwyer with us today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He's a speaker, educator, author, has degrees in landscape architecture, urban forestry. And we're going to look at some cool season plants, how to add fragrance to your garden, and we'll talk about shrubs as well. So, what garden questions or comments do you have? Join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Mark Dwyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
What plants are safe to put in at this time of the year?
Well, you know, this time of year, I think people get lulled into a sort of sense of false security with some nice sunny days as we're having today and feel that they're ready to put those tomatoes out and plant basil out in the container, out on the back deck. And there's a danger right now in planting some of our heat-loving or warm-season plants too early, simply because evening temperatures are too cool and the ground temperature is also quite cold. So it's not a bad time of year to install trees and shrubs, and certainly do your purchasing now, but I would wait a couple weeks until the soil warms up and just be a little more prudent with timing for those plants that'll really thrive once daytime temps get higher and that ground warms up.
And it's going to be start time probably in the southern part of the state a little earlier than the north.
Absolutely, and that should be taken into account because, you know, technically in the southern part of the state, the danger of frost, which I don't think we're headed towards anything like that at this point, but the danger of frost in mid-May is not unusual, but I woke up to 39 degrees this morning, and that's not something that's real conducive to tomatoes enjoying an overnight temperature of that caliber or some of those warm season herbs and such. So I think we tend to feel like we need to get started earlier, and I understand that, but understand your plants will take right off, particularly with the warmer weather arriving. So again, the season is well upon us, but people should adjust for their latitude in their location for sure.
Yeah, I never put my tomatoes in until the end of May, to be perfectly honest, and peppers even into June sometimes.
Mm-hmm. For sure, yeah.
What suggestions do you have for early greens?
Well, for early greens, it's not, you know, this time of year when you think of, I'm sure folks have heard of the term cool season plants or annuals or cool season vegetables. Because of the weather conditions I just mentioned that aren't conducive to heat-loving plants, it's actually a great time of year to sow or have sown already cool season greens like lettuces, beets, spinach. There's a lot of plants that will germinate very quickly, even in the cool temperatures. And, you know, as we speak, I sowed a whole bunch of lettuce seed about 3 weeks ago, and it's already 2 inches, 3 inches tall. It's taken right off. And, you know, getting those early season greens, what I'm doing is utilizing all my containers, my 70 containers out back, which will later host, you know, you talk about peppers and tomatoes, Larry. My warm season plants go in 3 or 4 weeks, but I'm taking advantage of the space with cool season greens to get some salad greens early. And that's one example of many.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And as I look around my neighborhood, I see some folks who have kind of mini greenhouses. And I'm talking here maybe 5 feet long and a couple of feet wide with the covers on them, have lettuce that's pretty tall already. And they're harvesting, and it's okay to harvest, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Yes. And, you know, you would be able with your lettuce crop, those folks will be able to cut back 2 or 3 times on that lettuce before they likely do something else in the heat of summer. And those mini greenhouses or cold frames or those devices and contraptions that help trap heat really can add to the growth rate. But it's important to understand venting and the fact that even on a sunny day that's 60 degrees, those can get extremely hot. So it's important to understand how to open and close those and deal with the venting. But what a great way to get a jump on spring.
Absolutely. Well, what about cool season annuals? What suggestions do you have there?
Well, I'm a huge fan. You know, I think a lot of folks are familiar with pansies being offered at area garden centers and nurseries, and certainly all of us should be buying locally. And pansies are a great example of a plant that can take the cooler temperatures, even a light frost, and provide early color before you would even think about putting petunias or geraniums or marigolds in. But other cool season annuals, there's plants like Nemesia is one, Diasia. I'm throwing out some Latin names here, but many of the garden centers will carry a whole host of early season plants that really thrive in that late April through May into June. And these are plants that do their best in the cooler portion of the year. These aren't plants that will thrive in the heat of July and August, but incorporating these into beds and containers gives you additional color on the early end of the season, and conversely, they can actually be used late in the season as well with similar conditions of temperature and lighting. So if people hopped on the internet and looked up cool season annuals, they would find an unbelievable assortment of plants. And the trick is certainly finding them or growing them on at this point in time. But once it heats up, we start segueing into those warm season plants. So, but consider the opportunity for bookending the seasons, as I say, getting additional color both in early spring and early fall.
Jill Nadeau, my producer, says she has her basil plots out with a big smile on her face. I want to switch to fragrant plants, and then we'll take some calls. But many folks love to have fragrant plants in their garden. You know, I kind of like the ornamental tobacco for mm-hmm. the fragrance. But what are some of your favorites?
Well, when you think of fragrance, two things to consider. Number one, there's really two methods of how fragrance is delivered from plants. There's emission. You know, right now in the southern part of the state, lilacs are at peak. So we're smelling yeah. the emission of the fragrance of lilacs. And there's also the tactile inducement of fragrance, you know, rubbing that basil at Jill's house or rosemary and some of the plants that you have to kind of rub and smell. Fragrance is subjective, so not everyone likes the same smells. But when I think of including fragrance in the garden, you know, spring is heavy with a lot of woody plants providing fragrance, fragrant viburnums, lilacs, fragrant abelia. There's a whole host of May into June blooming woodies that provide fragrance. But I like to include summer annuals. You alluded to flowering tobacco, Larry. The old-fashioned types that provide that sweet fragrance, particularly at dusk, can really perfume a garden. And there's a host of perennials that, when they do their thing, you know, think July with oriental lilies blooming and providing just amazing fragrance. So we can segue fragrance with woodies and perennials, but for the summer months, there's just a wide range of amazing annuals. One of my favorites being fragrant heliotrope, which has the scent of vanilla, which is just truly amazing. Mm. So positioning fragrance in areas of the garden where you can enjoy it, you know, by the back porch or the patio, areas where that smell is noticed and enjoyed. But you can have fragrance really from spring all the way through fall if you time it right.
Vicki in Black Earth has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I purchased a viburnum. It's a red feather one. I'm wondering when I can prune it and how much can I prune?
Sure. Yeah, and I think red feather is a variety of arrowwood viburnum, if I'm not mistaken. And arrowwood viburnum's having great fall color, beautiful flowers. You typically need more than one to get your best fruiting. But your question about pruning, at this point in time, as they're starting to leaf out, you can always do some thinning of the canes. You can always take out older canes. The real danger is if you have an overgrown one, your best time to prune that back would have been in March before it started foliating. You can always do a little bit of shaping, again, some of that architectural pruning, but if you need to downsize it, a more severe cutback in late winter, very early spring is your best bet before it puts out that first flush of growth. So if you're looking at something more severe, I'd wait till next spring, but do feel free to do a little cane thinning, so to speak, and a little bit of rounding as you see fit. And it's a beautiful plant, no doubt about it. But viburnums, again, your timing is typically in spring.
There you go, Vicki. Thank you for calling. Donald in Iron River, your turn. Hi, Donald.
Hello. Say, I've never grown potatoes before. I'm going to try them this year because every year I like to try something different. Do you have any tips or hints for me?
Well, great questions. I've not done a lot with potatoes myself, to be honest. So that might be something we can defer. When you think about the state of Wisconsin, the amazing amount of potato research that's being done by UW, I imagine there's all sorts of wonderful references on how to get started. But I've tried potatoes at home. I've tried various ways of hilling them. I've tried the tire method and adding soil. There's a lot of different ways of doing it, but again, I'm wary of recommending anything too specific because I don't have a lot of personal experience, but I do think there's references out there to help you along with the process.
All right, Donald, good luck. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Chris in Adams. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Good morning. I'm putting an arbor in this summer on my front sidewalk for a little bit of curb appeal. And I have two large trees, including a maple on the north side of my garden, which pretty much shades that part of the yard. So the bulk of the arbor will face east. The door will face east. The side on that side gets full sun from the east and the south. Now, is there something I can put on that north side which will get some morning sun from the east? That will be climbing that I can put in there is absolutely no possibility that it's growing there.
Chris, you're kind of breaking up. Did you get that, Mark?
I think so, yes. So it sounds like with the arbor, you've got an area with a little more sun, and of course, the sky's the limit with what you can grow there with your both east and south sun. Should be adequate for a wide range of vines. In the shade, there are options. The question I would throw back at you when you consider a trellis or an arbor, it's the method of securing the vines. You know, is there additional lath or something? Because vines, some vines tendril, some vines twine, some vines adhere with aerial rootlets. So there's different ways that vines will climb structures. But leaning into the shade, so I mentioned that because you may need to consider how to adapt the arbor to accommodate what I'm about to mention. But things like climbing hydrangea can take a bit of shade. Depending on, I'm trying to think of your zone there. There's a Japanese hydrangea vine, which is quite beautiful, but that can be a little touchy further north, called Schizophragma. And these are woody vines that will really adhere to a structure. There's also a vine called Dutchman's Pipe, which can take a lot of shade, but I'm wary of having you jot that down just yet, simply because I have it growing quite vigorously in my backyard, so I'm a little wary of that. But look into some of the vining honeysuckles, European honeysuckles. There's some great ones out there, including variegated forms. And my guess is if you go to your area nursery and mention those exact conditions that you need a vine for quite a bit of shade, they'll lead you in the right way. But consider also the root competition from those trees that are providing shade. That spot might be a little tough for something to establish. So there may be a lot of challenges existing, but I think, again, getting a little consultation on what will do well, and it's totally possible to have vines that will accommodate that shady portion of the arbor.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Chris. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Great to have him back. Certainly, if you have questions, I hope you'll join in. We have open lines get you on fairly quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Matt from Sussex is online, so let's go there. Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is when I heard somebody mention the plant heliotrope, my understanding is that plant dogs like to nibble on. And it is toxic to dogs. But maybe the next time you have your veterinarian guests on, you could ask them about that as well. But I would just be careful, or if people have that plant, you know, keep their dogs away from it.
Yeah.
So that's my only comment.
Thank you, Matt, for calling. Any comment, Mark?
No, I appreciate Matt calling in on that. And actually, I believe heliotrope may be toxic for humans as well. And that, you know, of course, that brings up the concern when you think about, you know, interior scapes, our houseplants. We're always wary about what our cats might nibble on, but certainly we need to consider our animals outside. So that's important to note. And if you do have dogs, maybe you consider heliotrope in a window box or a location where they can't get to it. And there are other opportunities for fragrance, but the internet has amazing resources, as do I'm sure our local vets, on potential poisonous plants in our yards. And it's important to know that. Absolutely.
Yeah, there are some pretty good websites that show plants that are poisonous for animals, and it's probably worth it to take a look at that as well. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Renee in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Renee.
Hi there. Yes, thank you. I live on a ridge, so it's fairly breezy, and I get a fair amount of, well, actually a lot of sun, and I have a clematis I'd like to plant, but I don't know where I need to plant it.
So you're interested in shade, or whether or not you can plant in shade?
Yeah, I do have some shade that I can plant it in. I just didn't know if it needed to be on a, does it need shade, all sun, 50-50?
Gotcha.
And just to clarify, you have a clematis vine?
Yes, clematis vine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they can take a lot of sun. I worry a little bit about your wind conditions. So there's very few clematis that'll take a lot of shade. So ultimately, I think if you could locate a sheltered position that gets quite a bit of sun, but perhaps some dappled afternoon shade, that may be ideal. And they do like decent soils that are well drained, so there's that component as well. And again, not knowing your location, it's tough to say, but if you have battering winds, I worry a little bit about the plant. If it's on a certain structure and the wind is just kind of whipping through it, maybe you have a little spot you can shelter it. But I wouldn't worry about too much light. I think it's more about decent soil and adequate moisture in the drainage component, and you should be good to go.
All right, Renee, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. What's been developing in the area of compact shrubs?
Well, you know, Larry, the breeding for compact forms of all sorts of plants has been going on for quite some time. And, I think the mentality is, you know, this plant is just too big for the average landscape, whether it's a tree or a shrub. Let's see if we can reduce its height, because it'll have more applicability in the smaller landscape. Certainly, there's the fact that they can sell more. And, you know, there's been some criticism of this, you know, everything being downsized. And I actually think it's a great opportunity for the consumer. And, you know, a great example, since we're in lilac season here in the southern portion of the state, I think about, you know, the old-fashioned French lilac that certainly wonderful fragrance, but when they're getting 15 to 20 feet tall, that's, you know, small tree size.
Yeah.
And we don't all have space for that. But the breeding now for reduced height in lilacs, there's now an old variety called Miss Kim has been out forever, and it gets pretty good size and time. There's now Baby Kim that gets about 3 foot by 3 foot. So there's a compact lilac right under the front windows on the south side. Panicled hydrangea is another great example. They used to always be quite large. Now there's panicled hydrangeas, great summer bloomers into fall, that are in that 3 to 4 foot range. So I think what it's doing is expanding the opportunity for the consumer, again, to get all the features of a plant that maybe was too ungainly or unwieldy in a traditional landscape, but have all those ornamentality and features of interest on a smaller statured plant. And I'm excited about it. I think it's great seeing those developments, because we have the choice to buy them or not.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one for sure. Mark in De Pere, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning. Thanks for calling.
I have a question on transplanting trees. We're getting ready to build our cabin in the north, and when we do, we're going to be moving a lot of trees, and I'd like to transplant them along our border of our land. And
you there, Mark?
Neighbor that we had at the time, he would take peat moss and he would dig the hole larger and then line it with peat moss. So I guess I'm not sure if that's just something he did or if you have any, you know, any good recommendations. What I'd like to do is maybe get my tractor, fill the bucket up with like soil or in peat moss or whatever I would need to kind of, you know, line the hole and get it ready. I guess I'll just take whatever recommendations you have.
And Mark, what do you know the types of trees that you would be transplanting and kind of their size?
Oh, sure. They're only maybe four to 5 feet, and balsam. There's some spruce, some red and white pine, just your average Northwoods, you know, lot. It just seems a shame to just, you know, cut them all down. So,
yeah.
Yeah, well, and it's a great opportunity to move them, and I kudos for doing that because they've already got a jump on life, and there's no reason you shouldn't try to utilize them. You know, in terms of that process of digging a hole and lining it with peat moss, my guess is that was for moisture retention and getting the roots to really get a jump on that space. But the important thing is, in essence, you'll be relocating them in soils they're already adapted to. So I don't know that it's as important to amend the soil as it is to do three things. The timing, your best bet for moving those is very late summer into fall, followed with heavy, heavy watering if you can accommodate that. Really water them in well. My guess is your soil's pretty well drained and maybe on the sandy side, so hence maybe the reason for that peat moss. And also plant them a little high when you relocate them because they'll settle into the hole, and there's a real danger in moving any size tree and planting it flush with grade because there's inevitable settling in that new hole, and then they end up being too deep. It's okay to amend that soil, but, you know, do know that the root system, 99% of that root system in 5 years will be out in your native soil there. So, again, I think it's important to plant them high. They'll never die. Water them heavily and time it for the cooler portion of the year, and it should be a slam dunk for you.
Mark, I hope that helps. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or go ahead and email us. Email address is ideas@wpr.org. And, you know, before we go back to the phones, it was quite a plant and seed shortage last year. How is it looking this year?
I think it's identical, Larry, to be honest, because I think and that bodes well for our local nurseries and garden centers, of course. But I'm hearing stories in Janesville here where sales are absolutely through the roof at our largest local garden centers are seeing sales that they've never seen before. And with some nice days and a really nice weather for Mother's Day weekend, it was insane, apparently. The shortages carried on into this year simply because a lot of stock that was earmarked for this year was sold last fall. So I don't think that should dissuade people from exploring and doing local shopping, but do know the hope is this fall and next spring things will get back to a little better with the supply versus demand. But I think gardening is here to stay, and I think the nursery industry will adjust to it. But I'm hearing a lot about shortages throughout, both with seeds and plants, woody plants, trees, shrubs. It's a bit challenging to find certain things, but we'll see how it all shakes out.
I know our local centers, our local garden local centers were just hopping whenever I've been there. But the good thing is most of them are doing a really good job. They've got a good system. I've seen really good systems for picking up your product and then getting it paid for and out the door. They're doing a really good bang-up job So don't let the crowds fool you. I mean, you can get in there and get your things and your plants and be out of there in pretty good time, and at least the places I've been at. Mm-hmm. Dan in Reedsburg will give you a chance. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've been a tree planter just as a hobby for 20 years, and I have two properties. One of them is sandy and shady. Shade created by old poplar trees and maple trees, big forest of that. And the other property is heavy clay soil and full sun. And the success rate in the heavy clay soil, I've been mostly planting coniferous trees, so mostly white pines, red pines, and balsam. And the success rate, even from the same batch of trees, is like night and day difference. With the ones planted in heavy soil with full sun being 3, 4, 5 times bigger. And I'm wondering if it's the shade or if it's the sandy soil that's creating the huge difference.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, I have to admit, I didn't catch some of that. It came through a little garbled on my end, but it sounded like the two properties and correct me if I'm wrong, but one more sandy and one more with clay. And the growth rate was better in the clay area. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. My theory, and I think you already hit the nail on the head, the fact that, you know, clay soil, a lot of people look at it, and there are limitations with what you can grow, but the moisture retentiveness of the clay likely lends itself to, again, a better growth rate. And particularly, we've had some fairly wet summers where if it's not standing water, most plants will have plenty of water for growth, whereas the lean soils, the sandier soils that quickly drain out, the limitation is likely water, and it sounded like a sunny spot too. So, I mean, that's the perfect comparison of the same plants in two different locations in that growth rate comparison. So I'm thinking your theory on the reasoning is sound.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan, for calling. Appreciate it. Peter in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you, Mark and Larry, for taking my phone call. I heard, maybe this is a little out of context, but I heard you talking about cold weather plants and dealing with them in the spring. My recommendation, I've had just fantastic luck with planting my spinach, lettuce, kale, really cold hardy vegetables in the fall, like winter wheat. I plant them probably when you do, probably after garlic. They'll come up, and when they're ready, they come up, and I've had spinach and lettuce for a month. No greenhouse or anything. So give it a try.
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah, they miss the opportunity. I think that's a great approach. And when you think about, again, that cool season approach applies certainly to the later months as well. And the challenge with the cool season plants is they really despise the heat of summer. But ultimately, we can take advantage of those more extreme seasons and have productivity and beauty, certainly, with these more cold-tolerant plants.
Yeah. Peter, thanks again. Judy in Watertown, on to you now. Hi, Judy.
Hi. So I have a simple question. I have irises that were planted before me, and the greens come up, and the iris is sort of hit or miss the last few years, and now I can see the roots flush with the surface of the lawn. And I heard that you should dig them up, but how do I handle, like, this big, gnarly root? Do I replant that in the fall, or what do I do with it? They're just a big, tangled mess.
Yeah, it's likely you have some sort of a bearded-type iris, which their rhizomes, actually, the top half to a third of the rhizome rides above grade. So you're seeing something that's likely normal. And it's not unusual to see a lack of flowering and vigor when they get so congested. So what you've inherited is an older mass of irises that does need your attention. The best time to do it is very late summer. This is in August.
and where you can dig up those rhizomes, and you'll get a mass of, you won't believe what you dig up. But you want to do two things. You need to look for iris borer, and there's ways to exclude or remove iris borer, which is quite common as a pest in these rhizomes. But breaking, separating, and slicing and dicing these is something that is relatively easy, and then you would replant yet that season and space them out and put them in new locations, planting them with that same portion of the rhizome above ground, assuming that, again, that's the type of iris. So you need to be patient for a couple months and tackle it later in the summer. But what you'll see next year is your newly divided and replanted chunks will bloom quite well and will thank you for it. And there's an amazing, the Madison Iris Society it has a lot of references, and hop online to see dividing bearded iris for a little more detail, because you want to sanitize your tools. There's things you need to do in addition to what I'm discussing, but you've identified the problem and you can deal with it yet this year.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as long as we're on it, is there a particular spade or shovel that you like to use for operations like that, Mark?
Boy, I can't think of a trade name necessarily, but I will say as a generality, keeping your tools absolutely sharp is so important. And, you know, back to the iris discussion, I remember when we had a massive iris collection at Rotary Gardens years ago and we were dividing it in summer. We were going through the process I just described, and we had extremely sharp tools. We were sanitizing tools between cuts and doing certain things. But I think the bane of any sort of divisions, plant perennial division or what have you, is having non-sharp tools, you know, tools that really need the attention. And there, you get what you pay for, and a lot of times more expensive brands are worth it and easier to maintain over time.
Yeah, that's worth talking about. Thank you. Barbara in Fort Atkinson, will move to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, thank you. My question is, I love pine trees, but I live in a small lot in the city, and there is electrical lines above me. So I was wondering if he could recommend a pretty little pine tree that maybe would only get 12 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're leaning into evergreens, if you're specific to pines, there are some more compact forms of just about any type of pine you can think of. There are more compact forms. I would encourage you to explore the range of evergreens, getting into spruces and firs, and talk with your local nursery about compact forms. And in that height range, there's a lot of, again, dwarf varieties that will eventually top out about that height. But expand, again, your palette. And I'm assuming it's full sun because that's ideal for pines, spruces, firs, everything I've just mentioned. But there's a wide range of conifers that would fit the bill. Because I imagine a traditional conifer, white pine or what have you, they get monstrously huge, which is likely what's happened for you. So those plants do exist. You just have to sniff around a bit for them.
All right. Thank you, Barbara, for calling. And let's turn to Judy in Wanakee. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about, I have two blue hydrangeas, and I have some aluminum sulfate. I want to know how much of the powder to put into a gallon of water and how often I should add that and how much I should add. We've recently moved here, so I have not treated the soil to make it more acidy.
Yeah, I think it's important for listeners to realize your approach, which is sound, for many of the blue-blooming macrophylla-type hydrangeas. To maintain that level of blue, you do need to acidify the soil, hence the aluminum sulfate. I know at Rotary Gardens we used a slow-release sulfur to help achieve some of that blue. So if you don't do it, they end up being pink or start leaning into white. They're still beautiful. But I can't say specifically how much of that product to mix into a gallon of water, although those facts, those references exist online or from a garden center. In terms of application, I imagine it would be a couple times, particularly during spring up till the flowering point. It's an amazing amount of work to
acidify the soil, and I don't want to dissuade anyone from trying it, but it's something that needs to be done quite often. And I will say at Rotary Gardens, we kind of gave up on it because we had neutral soil, and it took, we were applying so much sulfur just to get some semblance of blue. It just, we felt it wasn't worth it. But back to your question about how much and how to mix it, I would have to have you lean on some other folks to give you advice. And likely the packaging actually has some information that would give you that.
Yeah, I think it would. And I think maybe, would a soil test help Judy out at all?
Absolutely. You know, again, to get that best blue, the pH is typically under 6.6, you know, neutral being 7. But to get a pH of 7 down to 6 is no small feat. So, again, an aluminum sulfate's one of the better products to do that. But the challenge is certainly there to do it every year and maintain that level of blue. And I love that look, but there is some work behind it, and folks should know that.
Yeah. Thanks, Judy. Appreciate it. Karen emailed to ask if you could recommend some trees or shrubs that could provide screening from a neighbor's garage and backyard near utility lines. They are in zone 4. Her neighbor's new 2-story garage has created a lot of shade in that area.
Well, that can be a challenging spot with the shade, and I'm assuming the interest in the screen maybe is year-round. So assuming you don't have a deer issue, you might consider including some evergreens. And I know arborvitae are planted all over the place, but there's some great new arborvitae that are quite narrow and when used as hedging or in sequence are quite nice. There's one called North Pole. There's another called American Pillar. And they're quite narrow. And so the height is nice. Now, you mentioned, I think a power line might end up being an issue because I'm not sure what the clearance is for that. So trying to obscure a 2-story garage while accommodating for a power line might be the challenge. But maybe this narrow form will lend itself to that. There's also a great new privet. Now, this is a non-native plant, but it's a privet called Straight Talk, which is very narrow. And hardiness may be to zone 4. I would double check on that. But as a non-native plant, some folks don't have an interest in that. The planting width becomes a concern. How much room do you have to plant out to create that screen? So that will dictate the ultimate width of what you select if you catch my drift. But again, a year-round screen, you're leaning on evergreens, and really the best shade-tolerant evergreen in that situation is going to be those arborvitae.
All right. Good question, Karen. Thank you so much. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, speaker, educator, author. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Great to have him back. Thank you for joining us today. Mark, a listener emailed that she's waiting to put her zinnias in until the groundhog babies under her porch leave. What suggestions do you have for keeping them healthy for the next few weeks? Putting them on the outside table doesn't keep them from the groundhogs.
Yeah, that's a real challenge. You know, with groundhogs and pesky squirrels and other curious critters around, the challenge is excluding them from messing with your plants prior to installation. But I'm following the same pattern, and as we speak, I have zinnias at home in pots that I'm rotating out during the day, beautiful day today, some nice wind, and then pulling them in at night simply because of still temperatures around 40 degrees. So to our earlier conversation about cool soil temperatures and cool evening temps are not conducive for zinnias doing much. And there's a danger of them languishing in the soil this type of year, even in a container during this time of year, rather. But excluding the critters, that there's a lot of different ways of doing it, but you know, I don't know how many plants she has, but the groundhogs are voracious, and anything you can do to keep them up and maybe covered or some sort of netting or
but they can climb too, which is concerning. So I don't have some great advice because I spent 21 years at Rotary Gardens lamenting the damage from deer and groundhogs. So it's tough.
It is indeed. Terry in Fort Atkinson will give you a chance. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have red bee balm in a flower bed that is all sun, and every year I get mold on the bee balm. Is there any way I can prevent that now?
Well, great question. And, you know, the Monardas, all the bee balms in general, are prone to mildew issues, which is likely what you've experienced. Some of the newer varieties are less mildew prone, but I will say that the challenge, and I'm speaking as a Janesvillian in the southern part of the state, having some overly cool and damp summers has created mildew issues for a lot of Monardas, including some of the native species. So the mildew is more of a cosmetic issue, but there are certainly a wide range of fungicides that will take care of the mildew. And there's nothing you really can do now at this point, but as those leaves extend and we head into the summer, if we're getting excessive rains in June and July, and goodness knows we can use more rain across the state, just be wary. You know, you can apply fungicide to will knock out that mildew, but a lot of folks don't mind it. And one other point, though, at the end of the season when you're cutting it back, or even in spring if you're removing the foliage, dispose of it. Get it off-site, all the leaves and stems, because mildew has a way of perpetuating itself in the same location because of that leaf litter. So a little sanitation with removing the dormant portion of the plant is important.
Good points. And I just received a message from the DNR that there's a very high fire danger across Wisconsin, especially in the northern half of the state. But still, even moderate danger in, you know, Columbia County, Crawford, Dane, Dodge, those, you know, these southern counties as well. So as Mark says, there's a water issue right now, and that creates fire issues. Scott in Windsor will give you a chance. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if your guest could give me some advice, and us some advice, about post-bloom care for our spring bloomers, tulips, daffodils, hyacinths, and things like that. The tulips in particular, once the blossom is off, they're kind of unsightly. What do you do? And how do you build up the soil or the reserves so that they blossom very healthily next year?
Great questions. And the most important thing we can do for our bulbs is really is twofold. After they're done blooming, you know, they do fall into that phase where, as much as we enjoy the blooms, the post-bloom is a bit unsightly. So these plants still have to photosynthesize while the stems and leaves in particular are green. So they're taking in energy, of course, to recharge that bulb and be ready for next year. So we have to be willing to accommodate that time period. I will say with tulips, it's okay to cut the stem back to the next set of leaves, which gets rid of that stem. But tulips aren't ready to pull until usually 4 weeks after bloom. And if you give them a little tug and they sort of pop off the bulb, they're good to go. Daffodil foliage is extremely unsightly as it gets yellow and starts to flop. I normally will cut that as it flops over and is turning a good degree of yellow, which can be late June in the southern portion of the state. So the best thing you can do is interplant with other plants that sort of disguise them, because they still need to do their thing. But the other thought with, you know, building these plants up, they actually thrive with summer dormancy, dry summer dormancy. And one of the issues with tulips and hyacinths in particular, being native to Mediterranean regions, is their summer dormancy is dry. So one of the problems in our gardens is we're doing a lot of summer watering, and that's when tulips, you know, hanging out underground, and hyacinths and daffodils to a certain degree start to rot, simply because they're thinking, boy, I'd like to kind of hang out in a dry situation in summer, but they have issues of excessive moisture. So there's things you can do, again, cosmetically to tidy them up a little bit, disguise them with other plants, but you do need to let them run the course. and they'll let you know when it's time to cut them back. But rejuvenating the soil with compost and other products helps the plants over the long run. But some bulbs, like many of the tulips, just, you know, you don't usually get those for repeated years in terms of the same level or intensity of bloom or size of bloom. Some of our spring blooming bulbs wane over time, and we've all seen this where the flowers get smaller and start to disappear. So that's a lot. I gave you a lot to absorb there, but hopefully that gives you a little guidance on how to treat them.
Yeah. Scott, thank you very much for calling. Deborah, we'll give you a chance in Brown Deer. Hi.
Hello, Larry and Peter. I am going to plant a Sengal kaku tree, which I haven't been able to find yet. I had one in my garden when I lived in a house, but now I live in an apartment, and I asked the management if I could plant a Sengal kaku, and it's a Japanese coral bark maple. And it just looks just beautiful, and I really am so excited about this. And I wondered if you had any resources of where to find one and what kind of soil I should plant it in.
Well, it's a beautiful maple, and I've grown it. And I should say I've grown five, and I've killed five. So I just want to warn you. They're really touchy, so as are many Japanese maples. And when we had that polar vortices a couple of years ago, we saw many of the Acer palmatums, that species in particular, get knocked back, either die or have die back. So my experience has been touch and go. You alluded to that their best feature is the unbelievable intense red stem and branch coloration in winter. They're unbelievable. In terms of sources, the real danger is you're going to find sources, but you're going to find them grown in warmer climates. They're going to be sent from California or Washington or down south, and so they won't have been acclimated to our tough winter. So I would warn you, if you're going to plant it and you find one, put it in a sheltered spot that's shielded from winds out of the northwest, really good soil that's well-drained, and even consider additional wind protection, burlap, or some sort of a screen, because the danger isn't as much in cold temperature. It's that freezing and thawing craziness we have in March can really cause damage. But I will return to my original comment and say, I don't think I'm ever going to try another one again in even the southern portion of the state simply because of my success rate. Although I am aware of some being grown successfully near the lake in the Milwaukee area and in very sheltered locations on the southern portion of the state.
Deborah, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mike in Algoma. Hello.
Hey, good morning. My question has to do with trees which we are losing on a regular basis. Elms, maples. Around here, we're losing a lot of ash. I plant trees. I've got a big variety of them. But I'm curious, is there another disease or bug that's around the corner that's going to come and wipe out arborvitae, for instance?
I could see why you would ask that, because we've gotten burned so many times with, you know, starting with Dutch elm disease. And for those further out east, the chestnut issues, the billions of chestnuts literally that were wiped out, and emerald ash borer and all the things that are happening. Specifically, I don't know anything related to arborvitae. There's some adelgids and other little critters that are affecting hemlocks, and there's some pine issues in the Rocky Mountains that are concerning. But as it applies to the Midwest, I think your best bet maybe would be to contact Brian Huddleston for disease comments, or PJ Leash at the university for insect concerns. Mainly your extension service is keeping abreast of potential issues, so your local agent likely would have some information. And back to your question, I think it's important that we consider this, because I think we're learning a lesson with the ash, emerald ash borer, in that the fact that ashes were overplanted along our streetscapes for an obvious reason, they're tough and long-lived, now being wiped out. So we're repeating the problems with elms as well. So there could be something coming down the pipeline, but I'm not aware of it. But I think our university system and extension would be.
Yeah, PJ Leash is on the show next week on Wednesday. So Mike, if you can tune in that day, you'll be able to ask him. And Brian Huddleston, if you go to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, just go online and type in Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, you're going to find a site, and just shoot him a note. He's really good about answering pretty quickly those types of questions. So I'd highly recommend you get a hold of Brian that way, and tune in on Wednesday, and you can ask PJ Leash that question and see what he's got to say. So there you go. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, speaker, educator, and author. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we visit with Mark Dwyer, speaker, educator, author, degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, and his business is named Landscape Prescriptions by MD. So, what gardening questions do you have? Join the conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Amy emailed that the snow piled up high next to her arborvitae and gave rabbits lots of opportunities to feast on the greens of the trees. Will that growth halfway up come back?
Well, it's a great question, and it's an observation we saw a lot of after this winter, including in my backyard, where I saw nibbling on arborvitae about 4 feet up, as well as some of my small apple trees. And sure enough, it was rabbits that had gotten an elevated height to do some nibbling. But back to the question, you know, if she sees any green, you know, even stems nibbled further in, if there's any regeneration of green, which will become more apparent as we head into June, they will regenerate. The real challenge is if they've gone all the way into brown, it's nothing but stems that start to dry, that could be more problematic and be a permanent cosmetic issue. So I would give it time. You won't really know for another month or two, but if it does regenerate, consider next winter and, you know, some additional fencing, screening, netting, something, because arborvitae is the, you know, is the delectable choice for many critters.
For sure. Ron in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Hi. This suggestion is for Dan, but also for thousands of people who grow any type of plant in the Midwest, whether it's an arborvitae or a zucchini. A source of information to help him pick out the trees that will live best on his sandy soils or his clay soils. The federal USDA Agriculture Department has an agency called NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and generally they have offices that serve every county in the country, unless it's an extremely forested, mountainous county. So they have publications called soil surveys. I'm looking at the one for Dane County. So in that fellow's specific county, the table numbers may be different, but tables 3, 4, and 5 are specific about the different species of trees and shrubs, the different soils. They group soils together as to how well they're suited for different types of forest trees. So they will have somebody that can explain that more clearly than I can over the phone. My favorite table is number 8 because it shows what they call available water capacity. And that is the critical thing for his trees up there. If he has an extremely sandy soil, even 10 feet of soil, trying to grow a pine tree or a maple tree, you may get a half inch of water out of 10 feet of soil. But if he has a silty or loamy soil, out of 10 feet of soil, which the treatments might reach, he could get 20 inches of water to hold over the tree during a drought period. So whether someone's growing radishes or pines, it's essential to find out the different soils on your property so you can put a plant there that will survive and thrive. Their timber yields range from 32 board feet growth per year up to 310. So getting the right species of tree on the soil that can sustain it is critical. Thanks.
Thanks, Ron. I would agree with that. Mark, comment?
It sounds like a great reference. And I think to reiterate the point that was just made, the importance of knowing your soil and what it already accommodates is vital, because all too often, even in our modified soils, in our home landscapes, we don't know what we're up against, and many of our plant failures are related to not understanding the soil. So I think that's all great advice and great references.
Yeah, those NRCS publications are good publications for sure. Mm-hmm. And it never hurts to have a soil test. And if when you take that test, you tell the people what you're planning to put in that soil, and you'll usually get some really good advice in what needs modification or what whether or not it's going to work. So, mm-hmm. Ron, thanks. Mike in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. I got a comment and a couple of questions, specifically about the Japanese or Oriental maples. Recently, my wife and I visited the Arboretum and Conservatory down in Madison, and then we were up to the Arboretum in Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota one there. And apparently, they've developed a cross between a Korean and a Japanese maple that's cold hardy. And if I got the information correctly, it's supposed to be available commercially. And I was curious if you found out anything about that. But before you answer that question, here in La Crosse, we've got an area called Pamel Creek, which is a flood control project. And when they completed that, they planted quite a few different things along here. One of the things they planted were Japanese maples, and they seem to do really well here. And it's an area that when we've had temperatures, I've lived here for close to 30 years, and we've had temperatures around 30 below, and they haven't really noticed any cold damage to them over the years. They just keep getting bigger and bushier and more out of control. And now I'm ready for your answer.
Sure. Well, it sounds like those trees in the situation you just described are happy and have adapted real well. And of course, that's related to hardiness issues and the ability to withstand some of the stresses we have in the winter and drier summers. The hybrid maples you've alluded to, there's a range of them now that are amazing. And Longnecker Gardens of the UW Arboretum is featuring some of those hybrids, which are, I believe, Japanese and, as you mentioned, Korean maple crosses. So they end up having a combination of the benefits of certainly of both species, but are being touted as possibly even zone 4 hardy, which I think is truly amazing. Earlier in the show, I mentioned the polar vortices that affected a lot of Acer palmatums, the straight-up Japanese maples. What we're finding is the full moon maples, Acer japonicum, these are all in the bear with the Latin here, but Acer japonicum, Acer shiarsawanum, and the Korean maples, Acer pseudobuldianum, which is a mouthful, proved to be a lot hardier. So they're being used as breeding stock to create some of these hybrids, which I think are amazing. And I've seen the fall color on these plants too, which is striking. So I can't rattle off the names. I know there's one called North Wind Jade something or another. There's 5 or 6 now that have that hybrid parentage that are worthy of looking at for increased zone hardiness and withstanding the winters.
So I'm glad you mentioned those because they're becoming more readily available throughout the Midwest.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Diane in Iron County, we'll go to you next. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have some Lily of the Valley that are out of control, and I was thinking of trying to paint them with some Roundup, but they're intermixed with some May apples and some variegated Solomon seal. So will it kill them?
Well, the short answer is yes. And even if you're extremely careful with painting it on the Lily of the Valley, which as you're experiencing personally, it's a thug. I mean, it's fragrant and beautiful and bloom, but what a spreader. So everything is embedded together. So your best bet, and assuming you don't want to sacrifice the Solomon seal or the May apple, is to lift those out and rinse out the roots. Make sure you have no segments of the root structure of the Lily of the Valley, and then apply herbicide over the remaining Lily of the Valley, later inserting the plants elsewhere or holding them over to insert later in that spot. You need to separate them and then deal with the Lily of the Valley on its own. Or, again, sacrifice the whole batch, which is hard to do, but they're so embedded that you can't selectively deal with one without separating them.
Yeah, unfortunately. Diane, there you go. Thank you. Nancy in La Crosse emailed. She's interested in a north-facing screen using conifers. What effects would using junipers have on her crabapple and serviceberry trees? Would it be mostly cosmetic issue or harmful to those trees?
I guess I'm not sure how the question works in terms of shading or what.
I think it's in terms of disease that I'm just pulling this out of my head here, so I'm not positive. Junipers, is there a disease of junipers that can affect serviceberry and crabapple?
I believe, and I think we'll have to reference Brian on this, but I believe junipers will host cedar apple rust, which does affect members of the rose family, which include crabapples and serviceberries. So I would encourage her to look a little further into there because because I'm leaning towards saying yes, that there may be an issue there.
Yeah, Nancy, that would be a good one to shoot an email. Go to the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic online, and there's a way for you to email Brian Huddleston, and you can just ask that question of him, and you'll probably get a pretty quick answer. I'm not sure if it's going to kill the trees. I don't know, so I'm not going to say. But it could definitely have some impact for sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Jeff in Superior, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. It's 70 degrees up here in northern Wisconsin. It's a beautiful day.
Wow.
Yeah. So years ago, my grandfather used to tell me that his mother, my great grandmother, used to eat dandelion greens. They literally would pick them in their yard and boil them down and process them in such a way where they ate them. And I was curious, are there different species of dandelions, and are some edible or some not edible? I mean, how do you know which ones you can eat?
Huh, that's a good question. You are correct that the greens are edible. In fact, the entire plant is edible, including the roots. I'm only familiar with the Latin is Taraxacum officinale, which is prevalent throughout Europe and Asia. It has a northern hemispherical distribution like you wouldn't believe, as you can imagine. But in terms of edible greens, they have a wide and long-ranging use worldwide. To your question, are there different species? I'm not sure. I know there's a pink-blooming dandelion, which sounds kind of cool, but I'm not entirely sure on that, but my guess is that edibility may transfer over on these others, but some research would be warranted. But it's not an uncommon green to be utilized in salads, and it's extremely healthful as well. So dandelions get a bad rap, but again, there's something good about them, to be sure.
My brother Dennis made some wine once out of the dandelion buds, and it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad at all. So there you go, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Karen emailed, they have a quarter-mile tree buffer strip along their CRP fields. One of the tree types is nine bark, all of which were loaded with helicopter seeds last fall. Now the ground under the trees is loaded with nine bark seedlings, or seeding, yeah, seedlings. Should they spray with a broadleaf spray or just mow them off?
Well, that's a great question. My theory is I've not seen prolific reseeding of nine bark. So when she mentions the helicopter seedlings, I wonder if adjacent maples distributed the samaras, yeah, the helicopters, into the nine barks. But to answer the question, with all those seedlings, you could spray, but with enough cutting, if you were to mow those off and not let them get established, they'll lose vigor ultimately and not establish themselves. But I'm curious as to what they are. If they are maple seedlings, you need to get on top of it. But if you go the route of herbicide, it may take multiple applications to knock even those babies back.
Yeah, and if you're mowing on a fairly regular basis, I just mow them down. I mean, mm-hmm, over time, they're not coming back.
Right.
They get, yep, mowed down quite a few times. Mm-hmm. Mary in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello. If you use dandelions for salad greens, if you use them right away in the spring when they're first coming up, or if you have them shaded with something something over the top of them and they're still yellow or light green, they're perfect for salads and to make like a wilted salad out of them.
Yeah, they get a little bitter after a while.
Right, but at first they're great. And my dad used to have boats, and so the boats shaded that area. And so when we were cleaning them up for spring, underneath them, that's when we would always pick out our dandelions.
Oh, I like that story, Mary. Thank you. Mark, comment?
Yeah, get them while they're fresh. And that holds true with a lot of different greens. You know, get them before they get bitter. But hopefully you have some listeners that are going to be eating dandelions going forward.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, what suggestions do you have for resourcing unusual plants? There's always, you know, gardeners, they always like unusual, try new things. Do you got any source for that?
Well, it's tough to say. You know, I always encourage, again, for people to shop locally and ask at your local garden centers and nurseries to see what's going on. And, you know, I've used the adage, I didn't coin the phrase, but I've always said that, you know, new plants aren't always good and good plants aren't always new. So the fact that something might be new on the market doesn't necessarily mean it's adaptable or has been tested in our areas or will thrive. So it's always important to get to know the plant before you buy it, understand its needs, and have it thrive with your attention. So again, I think locally is the way to go. Subscribe to publications. There's a lot of great gardening magazines. But after shopping locally, the mail order business is also doing well, and that's where I start to expand some of my choices to more specialty types of plants. So for those avid gardeners or even new gardeners, you know, join gardening clubs, gardening groups, local societies, and chat with your neighbors and share that knowledge. And the resources are out there to direct you to a wide range of awesome plants.
You know, let's talk a little bit about your business. I mean, you are a speaker. You're an author, and your business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Tell us about your business.
Sure. Well, you know, I was at Rotary Gardens for 21 years, leaving back in the fall of 2019. And the business, the name Landscape Prescriptions by MD, I actually had in my back pocket for years. Landscape design is something I did, started many years ago and continued to do over the years. So moving into private practice, my business providing the service of landscape plans, just, you know, it ranges from people saying, what should I plant here and or how should I prune this tree, all the way to, hey, could I get a design layout, including a deck and a patio for my yard. So it runs the gamut, but I really am enjoying working with a lot of different clients primarily residential, but some commercial, and keeping fresh with plant material, coordinating with nurseries to see what's out there, and giving people some ideas for how they can improve their landscapes at home. And the timing is actually really good because folks are at home more, are out back and investing in their landscapes, hence our earlier conversation about nursery shortages and plant shortages. So it's all tied in, but I'm really enjoying what I'm doing.
And the speaking, you know, the COVID probably put a real hitch in that for you, but I imagine you were able to do some online as well.
It's quite interesting, Larry. Since March of last year, I think I've done maybe 50 Zoom-type presentations, and what I'm seeing is that trend may continue in addition to the in-personal format. I'm starting to do some in-person presentations, but we're finding that you can attract a vaster audience that will tune in and watch it virtually or on their own schedule, view a recording later. And so I've become comfortable with that format, but there's nothing like doing it live and being able to chat with other humans. So at some point soon, we'll get back to that as a more regular process, I'm sure.
And how do people get a hold of you or look you up and so forth?
Well, the best way to do it would be if you are internet savvy, just Google up landscape prescriptions by MD. And my contact information and information on what I'm doing is on that website. It'll come right up. I don't give out my phone number because I get endless calls, as you can imagine, on plant questions until I book a client. But I would encourage people to visit my website and reach out via email, which is on that website. And I would love to chat with folks and see how I can be of service.
And so how's your garden looking? Are you in good shape with that?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. I thought after leaving 70-hour work weeks at Rotary Gardens that I would have more time to spend in the garden, but I'm working just as much with the new business. But it's nice being able to be home a little more and get involved with the garden. But it's slowly getting out of hand, so I need to spend some time this weekend and get back to some weeding and some garden prep. We'll see how it goes.
Mark, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope we can do this again down the road.
Thanks, Larry. I appreciate you having me on.
Mark Dwyer, his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. So you can look that up if you want to talk some more with Mark. Just to let you know, next week on Garden Talk, Melinda Myers is going to be back. Haven't had her on for a while, so it'll be good to welcome her back. We're going to be talking about getting your garden ready for the season, and she has some planting tips that she wanted to share. That's next Friday on the Ideas Network. Monday at this time, our physical therapist will be back to talk about low back pain and the importance of working on core strength. That's Monday, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.